We are Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, trash talk is getting serious in Sullivan County, with a decades-old garbage plan finally updated and the county's landfill contract set to expire. The future of your waste is up in the air. What happens next could reshape how the county handles everything from compost to incineration. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Iser digs into the issue straight from the Monticello transfer station. As Albany debates a plastics crackdown, the industry is pushing for a softer alternative. The chemical industry is pushing to replace a sweeping plastics bill with a more business-friendly alternative. Colin Kitterborough from the New York Focus newsroom is here, and local economic perspective from James B. Huntington, plus Chamber Chats, the Chamber of the Northern Eastern Poconos. This is Radio Catskill. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russian and Ukrainian officials have concluded a second round of direct peace talks in Istanbul, Turkey. The short negotiations came just a day after Ukraine launched a surprise drone attack on air bases deep in the Russian heartland. NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
Moscow insists it has the upper hand on the battlefield and is demanding Ukraine cede territory and ambitions to join the NATO alliance and demilitarize. Yet the talks come a day after Ukraine launched surprise drone attacks on several remote Russian air bases. The timing of the operations seemed designed to show Kyiv's military potential remains, even as it says it's willing to sign on to a U.S.-backed ceasefire. President Trump has welcomed the direct talks and signaled progress towards peace or lack thereof. Will determine the U.S.'s next steps, including possibly sanctions on Russia, if Trump feels the Kremlin is dragging out negotiations. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
The FBI is helping authorities in Boulder, Colorado, after eight people were set on fire and injured during a peaceful demonstration yesterday. Authorities say a 45-year-old suspect used a homemade flamethrower and incendiary devices against a group marching in support of Israeli hostages in Gaza. The officials allege the man yelled, "Free Palestine." The attack is being investigated as terrorism. The Senate returns today from its recess. Senators must soon take up the House-passed government spending bill. The multi-trillion-dollar measure eked out a victory in the House by one vote. NPR's Tamara Keith says it's controversial because it features cuts to social programs such as Medicaid and food stamps.
The big questions are how hard it will be for Senate Republicans to pass this and how many changes they'll make to the House version. There's a lot of pressure on Senate Republicans because this is basically contains Trump's entire domestic agenda all in one bill. Tax cuts, immigration spending, cuts to Medicaid and other programs.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. Stocks opened lower this morning as companies that rely on steel and aluminum brace for higher tariffs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped nearly 400 points in early trading.
President Trump says he plans to double the existing tariff on imported steel and aluminum from 25 to 50%. Stocks of steel producers rose on the news, but the much larger number of businesses that use steel and aluminum are warning of higher prices on everything from six packs of soda pop to building materials and washing machines. The White House is relying on a national security statute to justify the steel and aluminum tariffs so they don't face the same legal challenge that's called many of the president's other import taxes into question. OPEC and its allies agreed over the weekend to boost oil production, but not as much as forecasters expected. Crude oil prices are up today, but retail gasoline prices are down. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 390 points. This is NPR. A California State Parole Board has recommended parole for one of cult leader Charles Manson's followers. Patricia Krenwinkel is serving a life prison term for her role in the grisly murders of pregnant actor Sharon Tate and six other people in 1969. Krenwinkel is 77. She was previously denied parole by California Governor Gavin Newsom. Heavy wildfires in central and western Canada have forced more than 25,000 people to flee in three provinces. Most of the evacuations are in Manitoba. That province lies to the north of Minnesota and North Dakota. The smoke from the wildfires is seeping south. Most of Minnesota is under an air quality alert. The tire corporation Goodyear is celebrating the 100th anniversary tomorrow of its fleet of blimps. From member station WKSU in Akron, Ohio, Kabir Bhatia has more.
Goodyear was already making airships for the military when it launched its first officially branded Goodyear blimp on June 3, 1925. Goodyear Assistant Chief Pilot Adam Bassrand says they have a fleet of three. Each blimp rotates between air docks in Florida, California, and Ohio to ensure equal exposure to the elements.
Down in Pompano, they have salt air pretty close to the base. Out in L.A., it's a sunnier environment, so there's UV issues. And here at Wingfoot Lake, we have an extended downtime in the winter.
The Goodyear blimp is largely used as an advertisement for the company. Despite the name, the current models are technically classified as semi-rigid airships. For NPR News, I'm Kabir Bhatia in Akron.
I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Last July, Sullivan County unveiled its first solid waste management plan in more than 30 years, a 10-year plan for how the county will manage its garbage. It includes expanding composting efforts and exploring a waste-to-energy facility. Now the chatter around trash is heating up. The county's contract with Seneca Meadows, New York State's biggest landfill, is up at the end of the year, and the future of Sullivan County's trash is uncertain. So what's really happening with your garbage? Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar paid a visit to the Monticello Transfer Station to find out.
Outside the Monticello Transfer Station, dozens of trucks drive in and out of Landfill Drive just off Broadway. Haulers pull into the landfill's tipping floor, unload, and keep on moving. Inside the main transfer building, the floor is stacked so high with trash that it's not that far from the ceiling. There are hundreds of trash bags, construction wood, and boxes and boxes. Cassie Thelman, recycling coordinator for Sullivan County, points to the back of the warehouse.
So underneath where those numbers are, you can't really tell, but there's like a big open hole.
Gotcha, okay.
So they just scoop it into that hole there.
And that's scoop it into the hole over there.
Yeah.
Okay. Once trucks are loaded, drivers bring several hundred tons of trash each day, 3 hours away from Monticello to Seneca Meadows Landfill in Waterloo, New York. But all of that could change. For years, this is how the county has handled its waste. And the county says it's worked well, even with the increase of waste from summer and fall tourism. But Sullivan County is at a crossroads for what to do with their trash moving forward. In 2024, the county released its first solid waste management plan in over 30 years. The proposal, which is 470 pages, details a 10-year plan for how the county hopes to manage its garbage, from expanding composting efforts to enhancing recycling initiatives. But the plan only works if all the players buy in. Community members, contract vendors, and the haulers bringing and taking away the garbage. And right now, there's a lot of disagreement on the right direction forward. For starters, the county's contract with Seneca Meadows is up at the end of this year. The state's largest 350-acre landfill has been trying to expand, but the Department of Environmental Conservation says they haven't granted its permit yet. The expansion would make Seneca Meadows larger and taller in size, and climate activists in the Finger Lakes region have pushed back against the proposal. With the future of the landfill uncertain and Sullivan County's contract ticking, District 7 legislator Joe Perello says the county is exploring other alternatives.
So right now, our contract's coming up this year. We're putting out a new RFP to see if we can get some better prices out there. I hope so. But with the contract we have existing right now, that we have to produce at the end of the year, fiscal year, 100,000 tons of garbage to keep the price that we have with them.
That means that the county is required to produce 100,000 tons of garbage for Seneca Meadows. And if they fall short,
if we don't keep that price, then we have to pay the difference.
One of the other alternatives that Perello, who chairs the Public Works Committee, is considering is called a waste-to-energy facility.
We've been talking about a waste-to-energy. We visited a waste-to-energy plant down in Long Island. I think it was last year sometime. Very sophisticated plant. They use the garbage for fuel, which feeds turbines, which makes electricity, which they feed back into the grid. I think that's an alternative. That's for us and for, you know, other counties can utilize this process to help with the garbage situation we have.
A waste-to-energy facility is a form of incineration. It creates energy by mass burning waste and converting it to generate heat and electricity. And it's something that the county is seriously considering, according to Perello. But not everyone's excited about bringing such a facility to Sullivan County. Here are several residents at county legislator meetings opposing the plant earlier this year.
Incineration would require an amount that we don't produce in this county.
No one who's developing new waste management plans around the country even considering it. People are trying to figure out how to get rid of their incinerators.
It is not an efficient system. You actually use up a lot more energy to actually process it than you do creating it. And the pollutants that it gives our area are really not worth considering.
For months, environmental advocates have pushed back at the public works meetings. Two of those members are Rebecca Kreshkoff and Eric Feinblatt, representatives from Sustainable Sullivan. It's a grassroots organization whose aim is to prevent an incinerator being built in Sullivan County or anywhere in the region.
Any incinerator makes energy, but not very much. It's the most expensive way possible to make energy. Burning garbage is not a good idea.
Incineration, I might add, doesn't eliminate landfills because for every ton of waste that's incinerated, you have 30 tons of toxic ash that have to go into a landfill. And that is concentrated toxins. So it's actually more harmful than what goes in traditional landfills.
Kreshkoff is concerned that the county doesn't produce enough waste to build the facility, that it would put the county in further financial troubles.
Sullivan doesn't have enough waste to feed the beast. We'd have to bring in waste, either do it regionally with several other counties or import waste from other locations to, in fact, feed the beast. Communities have gone bankrupt. The incinerator in Detroit is the primary reason Detroit went bankrupt. Same with Harrisburg, because these incinerators always come with what are called put or pay clauses. So you have to sign on the dotted line. We will generate X amount of waste. And if you don't, you still have to pay the same amount anyway.
In 2011, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania filed for Chapter 9 bankruptcy after building a waste-to-energy facility that left the city with more than $280 million in debt. These facilities have also historically been built in majority BIPOC communities, according to the Energy Justice Network. And some experts from the Natural Resources Defense Council have warned that these facilities are greenwashing disguised as environmental advances. They say it would release toxic chemicals and enter the region's air, water, and food supply. But legislator Perello says he's not buying it.
This is one stack that's going to put out so minimal of pollutions. I'm in the automotive business. I can't see that it's worse than seeing 100 tractor trailers a week traveling up and down the highway could be putting out less pollutants than that one stack. I can't see it.
Feinblatt worries that building such a facility in Sullivan County would transform how we think about waste.
It changes our relationship to waste in the sense it's antithetical to the idea of zero waste approach to solving a solid waste management problems, because that approach would steer us towards minimizing our waste. And what the incinerator does is steer us towards maximizing our waste. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's saying shove everything in. The more that you shove in, the more economically viable it is.
The you less have to keep on feeding the beast.
The less you shove in, the less economically viable it is. So it's putting us on a trajectory where we're just going to create more and more and more waste. And as Rebecca just said, feed the beast.
But building such a facility isn't an immediate solution and would take some time.
This waste to energy isn't an overnight thing either. This is going to take a 3 to 4 years for this to happen to get approvals, if it even happens.
All of these proposals, a new landfill contract or possibly even a new waste facility, These only work if everyone follows the rules. That means getting local residents and businesses to follow the rules that the county has set, like mandatory recycling and keeping trash produced in the county hauled in the county. Scott Mace, operations manager of Thompson Sanitation Company, said that waste compliance has proved challenging for years.
When you get a license to haul garbage in Sullivan County, you have rules that you have to go by. Whatever is generated and picked up here, we have to dispose of here. We are the only ones doing that exclusively. And most of the other haulers, when the price went up 25%, started taking it out of the county because it's cheaper. It's 25, 30% less to take it somewhere else.
Mace is referring to what is called flow control, a county law that says garbage generated locally must be disposed locally. Recently, the county legislature discovered that haulers are taking their trash to Orange County or Pennsylvania, where tipping fees are cheaper. And those tipping fees are expected to go up July 1st. Mace says the lack of compliance is a real problem for the county and ultimately taxpayers, since Sullivan County is required to meet 100,000 tons of waste dumped at Seneca Meadows each year.
If all these guys are going somewhere else to dump it, it's going to be much more difficult for the county to meet those commitments, and they're going to have to find that shortfall somewhere.
Yeah.
Right now, they're passing it completely on us. We are subsidizing the transfer station. Thompson Sanitation is really by far the biggest user of it, and that percentage should decrease quite a bit if everybody was hauling and disposing the way they're supposed to.
As Sullivan County continues looking for solutions, Feinblatt and Kreshkoff hope that the county explores how waste could not be a problem, but a resource.
A large percentage, 37% of the waste that goes into landfills are organic material. That organic material could be turned into compost, which could support community gardens, which could feed, you know, a population, significant population.
Kreshkoff pointed out that communities have gotten creative with how they manage waste, like building resource recovery parks, where folks dispose of materials like wood and bottles and make them available for the community. The next Public Works Committee is expected to meet on June 12th in Monticello. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll spend a little bit more time talking about waste, this time at the state level. As Albany debates a plastics crackdown, the industry is pushing for a softer alternative. We'll learn more next. This is Radio Catskill.
Psychologist Peter Gray has a message for parents and teachers. Let the kids play.
In many ways, adults have taken over children's lives. And I think the cost of that has been that it takes away from children's own opportunities to figure things out for themselves.
How to help children thrive, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This week's Retro Cocktail Hour is chock full of exotic sounds by the What It Do Archive Group, Martin Denny, and the Manicouras. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As New York inches closer to passing a landmark waste reduction legislation, the battle over how to rein in plastic pollution has grown fiercer and more politically tangled. Business groups have made no secret of their opposition to that major waste reduction bill currently advancing through the halls of Albany. Reporter Colin Kinnaber of New York Focus has been closely following this high-stakes clash. His reporting sheds light on how deep-pocketed interests are trying to steer the state's environmental future and what it means for New Yorkers. Colin, good morning.
Tim, good morning. Great to be on the show.
Thanks for being here. Can you just lay out a little bit about what's going on here with this major waste reduction bill that's advancing and then this other bill that's been proposed by the industry?
Absolutely. A couple of years ago, I believe it was in 2022 or beginning of 2023, rather, two state lawmakers, the chairs of the environmental committees, introduced a bill that would be really a sweeping effort to to crack down on waste, and especially plastic waste in New York State. It would require companies that sell packaged products to reduce the amount of packaging they sell. It would require a certain amount of packaging to be recyclable. It would ban or it would restrict certain technologies to reprocess waste plastics. And this has been, you know, sort of making headway in Albany over the last couple of years. It passed the Senate last year and then actually just passed the Senate again last week, but hasn't gotten through the Assembly yet. And all kinds of business groups have kind of banded together to oppose this over the last few years. The list really runs the gamut from, you know, Coca-Cola and L'Oreal to some of the biggest oil companies in the world, Shell and Exxon and other names you might recognize. And they've spent a lot of money, you know, hiring many, many lobbyists to oppose this bill. This year, there's also a new factor in the equation, as you mentioned, which is a law that these business groups are supporting that they say will be more workable, that has, you know, timelines that are easier to implement, that exempts certain kinds of waste and basically is less restrictive, wouldn't require companies to meet a strict, you know, limit on their packaging by any specific date. And, you know, the main purpose of that, they're saying, is to make sure that this is affordable for businesses to implement so that costs don't get passed down to consumers on store shelves.
And the bill that the businesses are backing, called a constructive solution, at least on paper, do you believe that industry groups sincerely want reform, or is this more about optics and perhaps delaying regulation?
You know, I couldn't tell you their exact intentions beyond what they told me. I have heard from a few different supporters of that bill that, you know, they're not necessarily optimistic that the bill that they're supporting this year would actually pass, given that the other one is so much further ahead in the legislative process, at least for now. But they partly see this as a way to maybe achieve a compromise, you know, to kind of shift the conversation and talk about a solution that might be more palatable for businesses, essentially, as opposed to, yeah, this more sweeping law.
You write also that oil giants like ExxonMobil and Shell, as well as the chemicals arm of Saudi Arabia's national oil company, have joined the ranks of industry interests lobbying on the bill this year. The Business Council has taken credit for crafting the bill in dialogue with its Senate sponsor, Monica Martinez, saying it was modeled after a similar bill signed by Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. Is how much of this Martinez Jackson bill, was the other senator, was actually authored or shaped by the Business Council, based on your reporting?
Yeah, I got slightly different versions of the story from Senator Martinez and from the Business Council. You know, the Business Council kind of presented it as something that they crafted with their members, you know, and put to Senator Martinez, you know, until they could get it to a point that she was happy with. She denied that any specific group wrote the bill for her. She said it was crafted with, you know, in dialogue with many stakeholders. So I can't tell you the exact details of how that all played out, but clearly, you know, there was some dialogue there. I should also mention, you know, I tried to reach out for an interview several times to the senator and to the assembly sponsor of the bill, and neither of them seemed to want to talk on the record. The best I could get was some written answers. So that's what they told me.
And also, just wanted to talk a little bit more about the emergence of this bill and this coordinated push behind it. How did you find out about this? And in your reporting, anything surprising you there?
Yeah, I originally heard about this bill from some of the proponents of, you know, the older bill, the longer standing bill, that's supported by environmentalists. They mentioned that, you know, there was this new bill going around this year. Of course, all the, you know, pending legislation is public. So I took a close look at both of the bills and compared them. And You know, I think part of what surprised me also, and of course I called around to, as we've been talking about, the some of the groups that are supporting this legislation, some of the early sponsors of it. One thing that surprised me, I mean, you know, there's a factor in this debate that isn't getting necessarily as much play, you know, in the way that the business groups are talking about this legislation. It's known as chemical recycling or advanced recycling. I think this is actually a big part of the debate in a lot of ways, because it's, you know, these are technologies that would allow businesses to recycle essentially, or like transform waste plastics that are currently very hard to recycle, you know, to kind of break them down into their original molecules and turn them into either fuels or into new plastics. And environmentalists basically see this as just another way of prolonging our dependence on plastics, you know, which have been shown to have all these health impacts and all these other impacts we're still, you know, learning about. And industry groups say this is a way to, you know, make things more sustainable without, you know, while preserving all these technologies that we've, you know, come to rely on. And as I understand it, some of the lawmakers, at least the assembly sponsor of the newer bill, the industry-backed recycling bill, actually went down to tour a chemical recycling facility in North Carolina. She was one of several assembly members who's done that over the last couple of years. So that was kind of interesting. You know, this lobbying effort expands way beyond the halls of Albany. The major national trade group for the U.S. chemical industry, the American Chemistry Council, has really led a lot of the lobbying on this. So I think that's a factor that people need to be looking at here.
And let's talk a little bit more about chemical recycling. And is there a third bill that sort of directly promotes this effort, this technique?
There is, yeah. Right now, New York State has a pretty restrictive approach to these technologies. There are a few different kinds, but the main ones are really, it's about heating these waste plastics to very high temperatures to break them down into their original molecules. And right now, that's essentially treated as incineration in New York, which is heavily restricted by environmental regulators. There's a bill that is in the mold of bills that have passed in about half of states around the country that would reclassify those technologies as manufacturing, which gets regulated much more lightly. That's something that, you know, the American Chemistry Council has very vocally supported in lots of states where it's passed. So there's a separate effort around that here. It hasn't really gained a lot of traction, but there's some overlap between sponsors of that legislation and some of the sponsors of the new bill, so it seemed relevant.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Colin Kinnebrough from New York Focus about his recent reporting. The chemical industry is pushing to replace a sweeping plastics bill that's making its way through Albany with a more business-friendly alternative. Speaking of business-friendly, how has the chemical industry lobbying impacted some of these bills? Has that increased in Albany?
It has increased. It's increased pretty sharply. I mean, I pulled the numbers for the last few years looking specifically at the Chemistry Council, which, again, I think is one of the biggest spenders here. And over, you know, from 2021, 22, before the more aggressive environmentalist-backed bill was introduced, they were spending about a little under $500,000 a year. Last year, they came closer to $1 million, around $930,000, and it looks like they could exceed that number this year. So clearly, you know, they see these stakes, these fights as very high stakes, and they're putting a lot of money into it. They've also spent some money supporting candidates through independent expenditure committees, you know, sort of like PACs. They can't communicate directly with the campaigns, but they sent out, in this case, mailers to support a bunch of incumbents in swing districts last fall. They spent about $250,000 on that, which is not chump change in New York politics. So yes, clearly there's been a lot of lobbying. You know, it's hard to say exactly what impact it's had. I mean, the legislation hasn't passed yet, obviously. It's one of the big items up for debate at the end of session this year, to see whether the assembly is going to move ahead with it as the Senate has. But clearly they've done a lot of work to try and shape the conversation.
What are some of the watchdog groups saying about the influence of chemical industry lobbying?
Well, some of the watchdogs I spoke with pretty much see this as, a classic example, bringing together a lot of the different ways that groups try to, in their words, buy influence in Albany. So everything from obviously the direct lobbying to, campaign contributions and then these independent expenditures, which, of course, again, the candidates aren't supposed to know about, and I have no indication that they did. But all these things together that are supposed to, just help them throw their weight around. Once again, these tours, this is something that the Chemistry Council specifically has made a point of doing all around the country, bringing lawmakers to various, chemicals facilities. And we saw that they've done that with New York State lawmakers, bringing them out of state to North Carolina. So that's an interesting factor as well.
You know, what's riding on this fight? This certainly cropped up a lot in Albany and other waste debates before. But you write that packaging is the biggest battleground yet. What are some of the things that are riding on this for both sides?
Yeah, I think that, the environmentalists certainly see this as like the major way that New York is going to combat plastic pollution. And I think pretty much everyone you talk to about this agrees that, not only is waste a huge problem, but we have too many plastics in our environment and we need to do something about it. For the environmentalists, that means drawing a hard line and saying, hey, we need to just stop producing so much packaging in the first place. For the industry, it's more about increasing, how much of it actually gets recycled. Stepping back even further, some of the big oil companies have made statements over the last couple of years to the effect that, plastics is kind of the next horizon. Now, this is before, Trump came into office with drill, baby, drill. So maybe we're back to, plan A for the oil companies in a way. But, with the transition to renewables still happening around the world, a lot of the oil companies were talking about plastics as really kind of the next big frontier to continue, their work in a way. So I think we need to keep that backdrop in mind as well.
And the two sides of this waste debate have traded dueling studies about what it would do to consumers, whether it would be more expensive and drive up costs. What do those studies say on either side here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, this is a point that the business groups and the skeptics of this more aggressive packaging bill have really hammered home. They've circulated studies that show one in particular, I believe, that shows that the direct cost to consumers could be up to around $200 a year. And then, they worry that there could be wider ripple effects in the economy that could cost, I forget the exact numbers, but in the few billion dollars a year. The other side will point to studies that, first of all, directly contradict that. They claim there'll be no immediate impact on consumers, but also that because, the companies that make packaging would actually be in charge of paying municipalities, for their trash pickup and recycling efforts, that, municipalities and, taxpayers would save a bunch of money. So I think the jury's still sort of out on that, honestly. There was an official study in California by the state environmental agency there that found that their packaging law, which had some overlap with the New York bill, could cost consumers as much as around $300 a year. That was on the high end of their estimate, and so they've actually gone back to the drawing board on how they're going to implement that. So I think there is a very real possibility that, consumers could see some increased upfront costs. I don't know that it would be certainly more noticeable or as noticeable nearly as any of the kinds of cost increases we've been seeing the last few years with wider inflation. But, I think people are reaching a limit with, willingness to put up with any more cost increases. So that argument certainly has a lot of salience in Albany at the moment.
And in Albany, the legislative session is entering its final weeks. Is there a realistic idea that this bill will get through committee, or do you think it's a negotiating tactic? Is there some sort of compromise? Read the tea leaves a little bit.
You know, the business tax bill has picked up a few sponsors over the last few weeks. I think in the assembly, it's up to, you know, it's in the low 20s, which is not nothing, but it's about a fifth of the Democratic conference. So clearly it's been gaining a little bit of support, but I don't think it's going to get out of committees. I mean, most of the sources I spoke to, you know, seem to think that, you know, it's in the environmental committees in both the assembly and the Senate. Chairs of those committees sponsor the older rival bill. So I'm not sure that it's going to move. I think the real question is whether, you know, the wider lobbying around this is going to prevent the other bill from coming into a vote in the assembly. That's still very much an open question. So I'll be watching over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and those big multinational corporations lobbying there too. Colin Kinneborough, a climate and environmental politics reporter for New York Focus. We've been talking about his most recent article, As Albany Debates Plastics Crackdown, the industry is pushing for a softer alternative. You can read all of his reporting at nysfocus.com. We'll also get it up on our website too. Colin, thank you so much, and we'll follow up with you as the legislature winds down.
Thank you. Great speaking with you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
For decades, kids in St. Louis County caught crawdads in Coldwater Creek. They made mud pies and went swimming and were exposed to nuclear waste.
If you live in North County, you can see the effects of this waste on the health and well-being of the community.
The little-known story of how St. Louis, Missouri became the dumping ground for nuclear waste generated by the Manhattan Project. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, we missed him for a couple of weeks, but he's back. James B. Huntington, local economist and author with Local Economic Perspective on a Monday. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
We hope you had a nice break there. It's good to have you back. Let's jump right in and talk about what is going on in the economy here, specifically about inflation last month with the latest numbers you got there.
Yes, we had a report that came in mid-May that the consumer price index rose 2.3% from a year earlier. That's the lowest since early 2021. That was from Tuesday the 13th. Prices over the course of the month were up 0.2%. That was the same number there than for the underlying inflation measure, which strips out food and energy items. That one was up more, 2.8%, because food and energy were down significantly, helped by eggs dropping 13% in April. So it's looking in good shape, but we have no idea really what will be happening with these tariffs. So we don't know how long that will continue. There are still some tariffs out there, and it's the usual back and forth. Some were affecting these numbers, but probably not very much. So there we have it.
Yep, the tariff yo-yoing continues, making it a little difficult to make some financial decisions and planning. But what is a good time right now for what big financial decisions?
Yes, this is a report that came out from Business Insider. It took some big possibilities and weighs in on how relatively good a time it is to do them. Okay. Buying a car, they say, a good time. It's maybe hurt by tariffs, but in general, there's a lot of inventory stacking up at a lot of dealers that has not been affected by the tariffs, so they don't have to retroactively charge them. So these cars are already stateside, and they're ready to sell and generally going for better than average prices. Investing in stocks, it's a good time for that. They say it's never a bad time for that, but it's hanging on. It's going up. It could go up more. It should keep going up with time. I think the fundamentals for the stock market are very good right now. So that's what they have. Starting a business, it's a good time. So a lot of businesses come out during chaotic times. So if you can read the market, if you've done your homework and are convinced that you can sell some things through a business, that it'll work for you, go ahead and do it. There's no reason not to, and it could turn out to be very profitable if our situation improved. Buying a house, what they have here is it's complicated. The trickiest question of the bunch. The bad news is that prices have been way high really ever since the pandemic by recent standards. Mortgage rates are not as good as they could be, but still it's a solid investment if you're willing to be patient, if you're not looking to flip something, if you're really looking just to live in it and then sell it as a matter of course 5 or 10 or more years from now. It's still looking like a good market, a good proposition. Job hunting, job hopping, a bad time. Yes, we have what they're calling a white-collar recession right now. Even though rates look good, supposedly, there are a lot of companies slowing way down on jobs right now, hiring slower, as well as not hiring as many people. We have the question mark of AI, which is not very well resolved, hanging over a lot of companies and many of their job decisions. So it's not looking good for that, and it's also not looking a good time for retiring. What he says here is, sorry, boomers, you're going to have to need to hold on a bit longer. Healthcare costs are rising. You may need more money, a little more money than you think you do. So it's not a terrible time, but it's, if you can handle putting it off for a year or some such, something you've been planning on doing it sooner, giving it another year, that would probably be to your financial advantage.
Let's talk a little bit more about the job market. You mentioned that a little bit there. Despite some of the stable employment rates, there are concerns that the job market may not be as robust as it appears. Why is that? Why is it appearing that way?
Well, I'm hearing from some more inside information from Yahoo Business that the labor market is kind of a wait-and-see era. Companies are taking a lot longer to fill their jobs. It's compared with October 2019, a few months before the pandemic, 91% of job openings from Russell 3,000 companies were filled in 6 months. This past October, that was down to under 50%. So companies are often waiting, stalling, maybe being a little fussier. And so that's not a good situation. And there are, of course, some of these concerns about ghost jobs, about applying and even interviewing for jobs that don't really exist. And AI has had a negative effect on applying and interviewing because you don't know really who you're talking to, or even if somebody is sending you questions in email form, if they are really a person. So although unemployment is fairly low at 4.2%, it's looking weak right now for white-collar cubicle sorts of jobs.
And something that I think I noticed over the weekend, or was it this morning? I can't remember. Polyworking, a phenomenon called polyworking. It's reportedly on the rise due to economic pressures. How prevalent is this trend, and what is it?
Yes, well, in a way, it's much the same as moonlighting or having side gigs. I caught an implication reading about this story that it may be especially suitable for when you're working more than one job at the same time. You log into your computer and you spend some amount of time working at your full-time remote job, but then you also have a side gig or something else you do. You might do it in the same day, the same thing on your computer, or even go back and forth. These nebulous sort of situations we have. So otherwise, it's getting quite common among Generation Z, the number of the workers they have that are in the force right now. It may turn out to be just a more modern term for moonlighting, but yeah. It doesn't really connote work going to the office and then going to another job on the way home. It seems more like you're doing more than one thing from your computer at home. Polyworking.
I don't know why we have to come up with new words for things. Moonlighting.
Yeah, sometimes it doesn't have a lot of merit, but it's not hugely different from the other ones we've seen.
Also, you've got an interesting story here. Speculation about the return of airships as a mode of transportation. Really? What's going on there?
Yes. Guess what? Well, we have, yes, the LTA Research, which is bankrolled by a Google co-founder, is testing Zeppelins, really, in effect. They have a 400-foot Pathfinder 1, and they are seeing what they can do with it and if it might work as an alternative transportation form. They're looking at the luxury market, something where there would be a glass bottom. It would be underneath the gondolas that have the passengers in them at the bottom will have glass bottoms, and tickets might be $5,000 or such. The catch that used to be true with airships was that they were very, very slow. So you could go 600 miles and it might take you 20 hours. These things used to cruise at 30 miles an hour. There's no mention here about the speed they might have, but if they really make cars and trains look fast, they might not get the kind of market they want. But they're describing it as a romantic experience, something people might like to do. I'm sure they'll have the whole market figured out if they do release these things, but they could be coming back.
You know, Jim, I'm going to have to start polyworking in order to afford a ticket on the Zeppelin.
Yes, I think so.
Let's talk about the current market. Gold prices surging, oil prices up. What's going on with the numbers and the market movement?
Okay, this is a three-week update. This is as of early this morning, as of the price changes are from 3 weeks ago. Gold at $33.50 is up $125. It's adjusting to the current uncertainty. It looks strong, really. Silver, $33.37, up $1.21. That ratio is hanging on at about 100 to 1, very close to that. Silver has been strong, but gold is so high that the alternatives may be better. And here is a cocktail party tip for you. I personally have been buying platinum and palladium, which over the last decade or three really have been around the same price as gold, but they're now less than one third. So you can get an ounce of either one for not much over $1,000, maybe $1,100, $1,200. So that might be your move. If things straighten themselves out to historical standards, you'll be looking much better than if you bought gold. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 42,270, up just over 1,000 over the 3 weeks, generally gaining. It wants to go up, but will our president let it? We don't know. NASDAQ, 19,113. That's up about 1,100. It's not only up more points, but it's on a lower base, so it's a higher percentage, doing even better. The AI situation seems quiet right now in the news, so that's been the real downside. Bad news from the AI front has hurt the NASDAQ, and we haven't had much over the last 3 weeks even. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $62.71, virtually unchanged, staying low. Pump prices are going down, and they may go down a bit more as they continue to settle. Bitcoin, $104,834. That's up $365 only, which is really as good as breaking even given its volatility. British pound, 1.3547, up 3.5 cents. That's way up. The dollar has been hurting, and the dollar may go down more with some of the things that are going on. Much the same happened with the euro, 1.1432, up 3 cents. Japanese, 100 yen, even got in the act and went up 2 cents to 70 cents, weakening dollars. So all these things are really moving targets, but fundamentally, we look like we're in good shape right now. If we can stay away from the monster tariffs, we'll be doing well.
All right, James B. Huntington, local economist and author with Local Economic Perspective. Good to have you back. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
And a reminder that the information in these segments is not financial advice. Seeking advice from a qualified financial professional is recommended before making any investment decision. We'll take a break, and when we come back, our Chamber Chats partnership with the Chamber of the Northern Poconos. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we take you to a special kind of quinceañera, a doble quince, a double 15th, a 30th birthday party, when Frank Rojas celebrates his special queer day.
It's my family also seeing for the first time, like, my gay family.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Jessie King. On this week's 51%, we chat with rising Broadway star Jasmine Amy Rogers about her Tony-nominated performance in Boop the Musical and how she gets in character for the iconic role of Betty Boop.
Betty shines through the most when I allow myself to shine through. It feels so similar to myself.
We also learn about the woman behind Barbie this week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, as part of our partnership with the Chamber of the Northern Poconos, it's Chamber Chats, where we check in with businesses and individuals throughout the Northeast Pennsylvania region. Today, it's Amy George Feldman, who's been named the CEO of Northeast Site Services as of March. She brings more than 20 years of nonprofit experience and says she's excited to expand services and continue supporting the region's blind and visually impaired community. And Amy George Feldman joins us now. Amy, good morning and congratulations on your new role.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And good morning to you guys. Thank you so much for having us today.
I mentioned that you've been with the organization for about 20 years. Before we talk about your journey there, talk a little bit more about Northeast Site Services and your mission there.
Absolutely. So the mission of Northeast Site Services is to help blind and visually impaired individuals achieve the best quality of life possible by providing services and support to them, as well as being very active in prevention of vision loss. And we do that through education and early detection.
And you've been there for 20 years. You are taking over from your predecessor, Sarah Pepperneau. How do you plan to build on her legacy? And what are your immediate priorities for the first few months of this role for you?
Well, I've actually only been with Northeast Site Services for about 10 years, 11 years, actually.
Right. So 20 years of nonprofit experience. Sorry about that. Yeah.
So really just kind of to keep the ball rolling. I mean, we have some wonderful things in the works, and I want to just kind of keep that going, keep spreading awareness, and, you know, just gaining more interest and getting more referrals and getting more people to know what our organization does and how we can really help benefit the lives of those that are dealing with vision loss, whether it's through our in-home independent living support, some of our social programming, you know, our vision rehab therapy, just really, you know, as an agency, we've been around for over 100 years at this point. And we serve Luzerne, Wyoming, Wayne, and Pike counties. And it's just amazing still that there are people that have never heard of our agency, you know, eye doctors that have never heard of us. So it's really continuing to just spread the mission and spread the awareness on how we can really help somebody.
And yeah, speaking to that, how can the public better support individuals with visual impairments in the mission of Northeast Sight Services?
Well, really, if there is someone that you know that is dealing with vision loss, I highly recommend you refer them to us. Have them give us a call. We will set up an appointment with them, you know, do an initial eval and kind of just figure out what their needs are, what their strengths are, what their obstacles are, and how we can help. And then we provide different resources to them initially, just, you know, if they happen to be a veteran or if transportation is an issue, which for many of our visually impaired clients, it is a very big issue. So getting them in touch with different agencies and organizations that can help them is our first step. Once that is done, then we kind of just develop a game plan for those that are dealing with vision loss. So again, like I mentioned, our independent in-home living support, that's essentially acting as someone's eyes. So our social service coordinators would come out to someone's home on a weekly basis, bi-weekly basis, once a month, and as needed basis, and read their mail, help them set up online banking, fill out forms, you know, just do some things, like I said, acting as their eyes to kind of help them remain as independent as possible. And then we also offer educational and social events. We have a monthly lunch and learn program that we hold in Honesdale. So we're excited about that because a lot of our clients who tend to be, you know, visually impaired tend to be of the senior population. So it's really nice to just kind of build that network of support, you know, kind of get them out of their homes and get them to meet other friends and other individuals who are dealing with some of the same challenges. So we love to see that. We also, you know, we can get them in touch with vision rehab therapy, which essentially acts as like an occupational therapy for someone's eyes. So there's a lot of different valuable things that our organization can help provide to someone who's dealing with vision loss. You know, it doesn't have to be all of those things. It could be one of them. It could be, you know, just coming in to our resource center and purchasing a magnifier that helps them, you know, live their daily life, you know, at a higher level than they were when they were struggling with their vision loss. So
we only have a few seconds left here, but I just want to ask you, what's inspiring you to do this work every day?
It's seeing the impact that you make,
yeah,
without a doubt. I was involved with the fundraising aspect of it for a number of years, and just seeing the dollars that you bring in and the literal impact that it actually makes on these individuals, you know, the friendships that have developed, people being able to see faces of their grandchildren that they've never seen when they've gotten a new magnifier, things like that are just, you know, what makes it worthwhile.
That's Amy George Feldman, CEO of Northeast Sight Services. There's more information at northeastsight.org. Amy, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you guys so much for having us. We appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats, as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving disinformation to fill the void. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction by building bridges and holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give what you can at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Sunny to partly cloudy today with a high of 65. Tonight's low 44, warming up the next few days as well. Sunny 76 for Tuesday, sunny and 84 for Wednesday. Some thunderstorms back in the forecast for Thursday. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.